call.
With that argument, that blowing the building up.
I'm going to call a hearing 2473 to. I want to call the committee to order first. Then I want to have a brief hearing of House Bill 2473 and listen to Representative Butler, and then we will return to House Bill 3013. Okay. Representative Butler, it is nice to have you here this morning.
Thank you, Senator Fields. Good to be back.
He's still got that goofy hat on?
That goofy hat, Senator Corcoran.
He has a beef with somebody.
I've got a beef.
Yeah,
so we need to return some jobs to rural Oregon.
Right. We need to return some money to rural Oregon, too.
Oh, I wouldn't vote
good
against
luck
that.
On you, buddy.
Thank you.
Nice seeing you.
This is Chair Shields, members of the committee, and Patty Corcoran. It's good to be back with you. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60, today I just am here for a presentation on House Bill 2473, and you'll hear more about 2473. Unfortunately, there's been something of a lightning rod created here, fearing that somehow the assistance of private aquaculture in the state of Oregon, as originally introduced a number of years ago, is some kind of a competition to the state of Oregon's public hatcheries, when on the contrary, there's evidence abundance that indicates that the more that we contract with private hatcheries and the more fishing opportunities which we provide, particularly the trophy fish and the other kinds of fish that private hatcheries within Oregon have been able to supply, that private aquaculture has actually increased the overall opportunities and increased the revenue of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. This bill originated from the idea that perhaps it was a good time to get our hands around the costs of from the private sector and provide a reference point of how much it would cost to replace some of the fish that were being produced in state-owned hatcheries. The second thing that this was to do was to provide a shock absorber when there were catastrophic issues that happened within some of our Oregon hatcheries, our publicly, the ODF&W publicly run hatcheries. Occasionally we'll have difficulties, and this lumps the private aquaculture with the publicly owned hatcheries to assist. It can become a shock absorber for times when the hatchery failures actually occur. And the third thing this bill does, or this opportunity does, is provides an interface between the private hatcheries and the ODF&W hatcheries for the environmental community relative to the best practices and implementing and employing best practices in the overall industry. Now, there are a number of conceptual changes that I would ask you to consider, and you'll see some A2 amendments which will come forward today, which implement a couple of these changes, and extending the sunset from 2006 to 2010, also requiring that the department go ahead and examine the private aquaculture opportunities through a private aquaculture advisory committee to the ODF&W, allowing us an opportunity to go ahead. And then finally, a change which was indicated in a meeting on May the 13th with Director Ball. He was concerned that the 10%, which is in law at present, is too much in relationship to the amount of private aquaculture that the state should be engaged in. And consequently, what we have anticipated is, and we are requesting a modification, and conceptually I would appreciate your discussing it this today in these hearings, that an amount in determining rather than 10%, because it's my understanding that Director Ball's position and his staff's position is if we continue with the 10% in law, that this could jeopardize some of the public hatcheries. And this law was never intended to jeopardize any public hatcheries. And so what we're asking, in lieu of 10%, that the amount that the department shall spend shall be an amount not less than the amount expended for aquaculture products purchased from private aquaculture facilities in the 2001-2003 biennium. And that language, The folks that are here today to speak on behalf of the bill, they have that language, and I would appreciate your consideration of that as we continue forward. Again, this should not then jeopardize any of the existing hatcheries within the state of Oregon, but still give us an opportunity to buy fish privately from private aquaculture facilities within the state of Oregon and to allow the best practices to continue forward. And colleagues, since this bill has been presented, I am aware that there has been at least one lawsuit now, which could be a very substantial lawsuit against some of the environmental practices within the that are being practiced presently within the Oregon hatcheries, within these publicly operated and publicly owned hatcheries by the ODF&W. I'm concerned about their viability if they continue on. And again, this is the concern that we should have best practices continued by the public aquaculture, the same as private aquaculture is presently demanded to employ in their facilities. So I would appreciate your favorable consideration with these amendments so that this bill can continue to come forward and we can continue to enjoy the very best of both the public-private partnership which has been generated over these number of years. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. My apologies. I got distracted there for a minute at the end of your testimony. I know that you were talking about the 10% issue and that there is language, a proposed conceptual amendment that says not less than the amount spent by the department during the 2001-03 biennium.
Mr. Chair Shields, that's exactly correct. That's
Did I hear you make any comments on any of the other proposed amendments?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, the extension of the sunset is to be extended to 2010, okay. And we have the A2 amendments which will be presented at your hearing. And the A2 amendments do extend it to 2010. The current pilot program would be extended to 2010 so that the sunset would go out. This gives us that opportunity to also have this advisory to examine the best practices, and really some of the reason for the examination of the best practices now unfortunately have come about as a result of a different separate issue, which is a private lawsuit which is being brought by other folks in the environmental community anxious over the environmental aspects of the operation of the okay. ODF&W's facilities.
Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You,
Are there
Chair.
Questions that anybody would like to ask? Senator Fisher.
Representative Butler, the A2 amendments, I understand, don't cover all the area that you talked about, so that there would be a necessity of the A2 plus some conceptual.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, absolutely. The A2 amendments were drafted coming out of the House. Since that time, we've had additional conversations with the director, and then a private conversation with the director down at ODF or down at Legislative Fiscal Office. The concern of the department was that 10% was still way too much, even though that is within the body of the present law. The director expressed that they would continue to buy private fish from private aquaculture in Oregon. That wasn't the issue. That 10% was the amount that he would have to start to close down hatcheries and potentially in Senator Duke's district, potentially in Senator Messerly's district, if in fact we were forced to do 10%. This bill was never intended to close any hatcheries down. Believe you me, it was never intended to do anything other than just augment and provide some of the fish that private industry can provide cheaper than what the ODF&W can provide them. So the conceptual amendment, I think the one with the greatest amount of weight today, which is going into LC today, shall provide that the department shall spend an amount of not less than the amount expected or expended for aquaculture products purchased from the private aquaculture facilities in the 2001-2003 biennium. They've established an amount which they have expended right now. There's a line item, plus they purchased some trophy fish. It's my understanding the total of those amounts are something in the vicinity of around $400,000. That 10% would probably be closer to $700,000, but that we've agreed in the past that these purchases which have been made are amounts that thus far have not been to the detriment of the department.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How does a private guy provide a fish cheaper than a government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I think that number one, private industry has to be examining all of the aspects, and that's why originally this was a very good idea, was to make sure.
I don't want a CPA's answer. How do you provide a fish cheaper in the private sector than you do in the public sector?
You watch your P's and Q's very, very carefully.
So, like wages, benefits, that kind of thing?
It's not that nearly as much, Chair Shields, Senator Corcoran. It's not wages and benefits nearly as much as it is the actual water source and examining just best practices of operating your hatcheries.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I finish?
Senator Fisher.
So on this proposed amendment concept, the number one is most important. Number two is already covered in the amendment, the H2 amendment.
Yes, Senator Shields, Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, it's my understanding that number one will be that is to replace the 10% with the amount, and I have more specific language on the proposed amendment. And then number two is taken care of in the dash A2 amendments. Number three and number four are taken care of in the dash A2 amendments. So okay. It's just the conceptual as to the item number one, which is 10%. That's a late evolving issue that the department was concerned about.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for coming
in. Thank you, Chair.
Now, see what happens. I wanted to make sure we got Representative Butler in here because you have some medical issues to pay attention to this morning. And so a couple other representatives and senators, I have to let them hold forth for a few minutes to extend courtesies to them. So I'm going to invite them to come forward addressing House Bill 2473. Senator Dukes, did you want to make any comments on 2473? Yeah, excuse me, 3094. Since you're here, do you want to make your comments now on 3094?
You want to open up?
Okay. To extend that courteously, let's do that. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2473 and open a hearing on House Bill 3094. I'm just trying to get you folks to go, be able to go back to your jobs.
You don't want us to sit and watch what you're doing on the other bill?
Oh, you wanted? I thought you wanted to speak on the other bill.
Yeah, you're a big proponent of that trout bill.
Yes,
I understand.
I'm sure. I may, since I have you here, ask you a few questions about that other bill while we're at it. Okay, let's begin with the 3094.
Good morning, Senator Shields, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from House District 31. We're here advocating on behalf of 3094, which passed the House unanimously. This is a bill that would allow fisher persons to sell fish directly to the public without the requirement that they have to be on their boat. I carried this bill on the floor. It passed unanimously on the House side. The way that I characterized it was Astoria has a wonderful farmer's market. It's right down on the water. You can see the Columbia River. You can buy all kinds of produce there, exotic lettuces, mushrooms. What you can't buy is a fish, even though you can see the river from the market. And what this bill would allow is the opportunity for a traditional industry at the mouth of the river that has been buffeted by regulation and hard economic times. This would provide a new outlet for fishermen to bring their fish directly to the public so that you could actually buy the fish from the fellow that caught it and have this new outlet for this struggling industry to be able to provide their beautiful product to the market.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Wouldn't this bill endanger us in the sense that we might have to confront face-to-face people like Terry Thompson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, you raise a very valid point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Joan Dukes. I'm State Senator from District 16, and I'm here in support of this bill. We're getting creative, and we have to get creative sort of to keep the industry going and through the ups and the downs. The ups we can handle, the downs we're having a little trouble with, and this is just another way to help some of these fishermen through the difficult times. It's a pilot project. It's not going to have a big impact on anybody but the fishermen and the consumers who really want that very fresh caught fish and are denied that today. So I think a lot of people come to coastal communities thinking they're going to be able to do something like this and then run into a problem and are disappointed. So this will help them to be able to buy those fish. And I think it's a good bill. It'll help them. A little economic development for the North Coast, but I hope you will look kindly on it. It's a nice little bill that will have an impact for an important group of people whose history goes back probably prior to the state of Oregon.
In other words, you're not worried about opposition from the owners of Pike Street Market up in Seattle, that they're worried that this will displace it and put them out of business up there or something?
No, Mr. Chair.
Not worried about it.
Not a concern.
Okay. Would you go ahead?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm John Westerholm from Astoria, Columbia River Fishermen's Protective Union. I'm a commercial fisherman on the Columbia River. We are the ones that originated the idea behind this bill. And right off the top here, I want to say thanks to Representative Johnson and Senator Dukes, because especially Representative Johnson was very attractive to the purpose for this bill. She attended the annual meeting a couple of years ago in which we thoroughly discussed the issues here of 30 cents a pound for coho salmon in September, which from the processors in Astoria, which is below the break-even point for the commercial fishermen. And there was a need for a better way to get those fish directly to the consumer with a little better price for the fishermen and a privilege for the consumer, the non-angling consumer that doesn't have access to this and may have to pay a fairly middleman inflated price at the market to get this fish. This way, it makes it easier for that to take place. You mentioned the market in Seattle. There are several markets down on Fisherman's Wharf in Seattle, they call it the Wall, where they do sell fish directly off of the boat to consumers, and that has been a real positive point. And I just wanted to make just a couple of comments, and then maybe there'll be some more questions that you want to ask. Let's see. I apologize for the lack of clarity on my copy that you have, but I think that really explains our purpose. This was the same information that was used in the House committee, so I think it explains very well what our situation is. We are not trying to run competition with the processors themselves, but we're trying to take care of the surplus that they can't seem to find a good market for. And so, and then also, it should be noted that the state of Washington is doing the same thing. They have a bill there that is going through their chambers, and so it'll be kind of fairly even on both sides of the river for Washington fishermen and for Oregon fishermen. And we're looking forward to passage of this bill and getting to work with the ODF&W to set up the rules and regulations that we're going to have to go by. And incidentally, we did add the emergency clause to it so that it goes into effect immediately. We have a heck of a projection for cohos, for silvers this fall, and we're going to fall right into the same boat that we've been in the last couple of years, no price. And so we want to be able to use this in September of this year. Thank you very much.
Okay. Other questions of yes, Senator Boyer.
Thank you. You speak of the fall coho. This is not limited to that. It's all fish, right?
Yeah, pardon me?
I said that you're talking directly about the fall coho run, but this is not limited only to the fall coho run. This is for all.
Oh, this is for all salmon on the Columbia. But basically, it started because of the lack of market for the coho in the fall. Oh yes, it'll be used for all Columbia River salmon.
Senator Byer.
Thank you. The currently fish in some fisheries, you know, you're limited to certain quotas of fish per boat or per fishery or whatever. How is this going to be tracked? I mean, because now the fish are sold to a processing plant, and that's where they get their count as far as how many fish are being caught to fit that quota. How will this be tracked?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, ODF&W has been enormously cooperative in helping us put in place the framework for the rules. They have indicated that they are ready to begin drafting rules immediately, and I would presume that we would put those kind of safeguards in the rules.
Other questions?
No, I think that's it.
Any other questions?
I'm very concerned about not having an anti-Terry Thompson provision in this bill. This would be scary for the legislature to allow people to have Thompson sell them fish directly. Oh, Thompson would go up to, if it was money, Thompson would be up to Columbia in a heartbeat. He's a commercial fisherman, for God's sake.
Mr. Chair, for the record, he doesn't have a permit on the Columbia.
For the record, he's a commercial fisherman.
Mr. Chair, just to be a little more specific.
Permit.
Okay, never mind.
We could post warnings near the near.
That would be fine. Does that satisfy? Put the amendment in and it's a done deal.
Okay, well, what I've committed to a schedule this morning, so I'm going to... Is anybody else here on this bill? There's a couple other people back there. All right, we'll just finish this one. We'll ask you to step back, and whoever raised their hands, come on up here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Kay Brown here on my left, who's the Program Manager and Policy Advisor for Fish Division at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Just wanted to give our affirmation from the department to the committee that we've worked closely with Representative Johnson and the Columbia River Gillnetters Union and Senator Dukes on this bill. And we are preparing to go to rulemaking in front of our commission in July to facilitate the September sale for these fishermen away from their boats on the coho season, which starts, I believe, early September.
Okay. Kay, do you have anything you want to add?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Kay Brown with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We've passed out written testimony and just let you know that we are in support of the bill. I just wanted to make the comment that this is a pilot program. That's why it has our support. We do have some concerns about tracking fish, public health, and those sorts of things, which by keeping it limited to just a small fishery, the Columbia fishery, we believe that it'll give us the ability to find out if this is something that we'd want to apply statewide in the future. So we can support this bill on the basis of that.
You do raise an interesting question. Does Washington have this statewide? I mean, testimony was just given to us that there are several people in Seattle you know, at the wall, quote unquote. Do they do it all over the state there, or do they? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain of what the situation is in Washington. I couldn't testify to that.
I was just wondering. Are there other questions? Senator Bach.
Thank you. The bill says they have to comply with Department of Ag licensing for food and handling requirements. So are your rules going to reflect that, or is this something different? The fishermen are going to get a food handling license, and what does that entail?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, when we sat down and worked out the details in the pilot program, we did have Department of Ag there present. I believe the fishermen who do sail away from their boats are going to have to get a food handling license or permit. I'm not sure the exact title of the permit, but Ag pretty much, the Ag Department said there'd be no exceptions to that. They were concerned, of course, about the health and safety issues, and my sense is that the fishermen are going to comply with all the ag requirements currently involving with food sales of this kind.
Let me build on Senator Beyer's question. When we did just a dinner for folks at our church, the public, everybody had to get a food handler's license, and that was just like watching a half an hour video or whatever, and just learning some basics, and that's basically all you're talking about, right?
Mr. Chair, I can't give the details for the ag program, but it sounded like there's when we met with ag that they do have a couple of roving inspectors that will be checking on people making these sales and things like that. So I think it was more than just a video, but I cannot give the details other than that the fishermen, everyone was aware that they would have to comply with all the ag regulations, whatever they may be, and ag was going to help us with the rules as we prepare to take them to the commission in July.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Are there other questions that anybody has? Well, let's just close the hearing, and the co-chair and I have decided just to go to a work session right now on House Bill 3994, so let's do a work session on that. 3094. That's what I said, 3094.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I just wanted to give an update on fiscal ceramics.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Just to complete the information puzzle here, we have received a no revenue impact on 3094A and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see amendments. I just want to move House Bill 3094A and go to the floor with a detailed recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 3094, House Bill 3094A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the bill? Is there an amendment? There is no amendment on this one. Would, if there's no discussion, would the clerk call the roll?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. So House Bill 3094 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I would like to ask Senator Dukes if she'd carry the bill. With that, let's return to the schedule that we said we'd do today, and that's to open a hearing on House Bill 3013. And Representative Johnson is here and wanted to talk about that one. At least you're signed up here, so do you want to do that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I was distracted at your opening hearing on
3013.
Yes,
do you want to, since you're here, do you want to do we'd like to give you the courtesy of doing testimony first, or did you want to wait a while?
I do something.
Okay.
So that would be lovely.
Let's do it then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the courtesy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Betsy Johnson, and I'm here today to express my very strong opposition to House Bill 3013. Statewide, the issue of how and where surface mining should be allowed has often resulted in bitter, protracted local battles. Nowhere has this conflict of needs been of mining interests in local residents been more pronounced than in Columbia County. One such conflict that I was personally involved in lasted over 20 years in the Scappoose area and was resolved the week before Christmas to the satisfaction of the mining company and all of the local residents. However, during those 20 years, hundreds of thousands of dollars and countless hours of hearings were expended on both sides. The successful resolution came about in no small part due to the provisions of statewide Planning Goal 5. House Bill 3013 repeals one of the most critical elements of Goal 5 as it relates to surface mining, the issue of significant mining sites. As we all know, every local jurisdiction is required to adopt a comprehensive land use plan. One provision of the plan must address aggregate sand and gravel reserves within the plan's jurisdiction. Reasonable people will agree and disagree that mining is a necessary activity, but at the same time acknowledge that it is a destructive activity. We all require aggregate, whether it's for roads, highways, new homes, whatever. But because the extraction of aggregate results in such serious adverse impacts, local land use plans currently are required to address where aggregate mining should be conducted with the least impact. Goal 5 establishes the criteria by which a local government must apply to determine if a potential aggregate mining site is of such significance that it must be protected and preserved for the extraction of aggregate material. One criteria is that the site must contain at least 2 million cubic yards of marketable material. This requirement makes sense and should be retained. If mining is to occur with all of its attendant effects of noise, dust, and the resultant destruction of the landscape, the least we should do is to ensure that the activity is worthwhile. House Bill 3013 deletes the requirement that a mining permit may only be issued for a site that has been deemed by a local body to be significant. This proposal, introduced by the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, would require local jurisdictions to issue a surface mining permit to a company to mine anywhere in Oregon. 2 million cubic yard test for significance was adopted by LCDC at the request of OCAPA and its member companies to assure Oregonians that mining would occur only on sites that truly merit the land use protections and would add economic benefit to the community. Many opponents of surface mining urge DLCD to establish an even higher standard of significance, but the 2 million yard test was eventually adopted with the full support of OCAPA. Now OCAPA wants no standards at all. House Bill 3013 is not only bad public policy, but its very introduction should be a warning to Oregonians that OCAPA apparently believes that compromises in the public interest, such as significant sites, are to be adhered to only until the next session of the Oregon Legislature. I urge members of this committee to endorse the current policy of protecting significant aggregate sites and reject 3013.
Question for you, Representative
Johnson.
Representative Johnson. I know. I tried to say Betsy, and I wasn't supposed to, and then I ended up all messed up here. Your biggest issue in your testimony is the whole issue of significant mining sites.
Yes, sir.
Is there a way to get a compromise, and this is something that I've been talking about ever since I first heard about this bill. I've spent a lot more time on this bill than probably any other, including the field trips, and I guess I shouldn't say field trips, I should say field trips and pit trips, because I've had both out into farmland into gravel pits. Is there any way to get to this issue without the kind of legislation here that would at the same time keep intact the ODOT sites that we need for the transportation plan? I mean, this bill is certainly not in isolation. It's affecting a lot of things.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think there is. I think that there would be, through amendment, ways to put sideboards on the basic elements of 3013. For example, describing certain soils or the pits over a certain size or proximity to people or quality and quantity. I completely understand that there are isolated small pits, particularly in rural and eastern Oregon, that are absolutely necessary to keep the price of aggregate down. The concern that I have is for Columbia County, which ostensibly is one of the largest gravel resources in the whole state. We're part of a great alluvial plain washed by the Columbia River, and you could dig almost anywhere and find gravel. where we have run into conflicts in Columbia County is where, as you balance the elements of Goal 5, you find now that gravel disproportionately wins out over other uses, and less attention has been paid to the very negative impact of aggregate mining on groupings of people. The site that we contested so aggressively in Scappoose was quite near the homes of a lot of elderly and low-income folks. And very little attention was paid to their health as a result of the dust generated, the impact of traffic. So I think that you could chart a middle course through this instead of just saying any site qualifies for a conditional use. And you could try to put some sideboards that describe sites that are well away from aggregations of people or where any of the other impacts such as traffic, noise, dust, hours of operation would be a problem. I would like to help try to find a middle ground. My main problem with House Bill 3013 is I think it simply goes too far.
I was writing as fast as I could. You had to describe certain soils. Proximity to people, dust, traffic, hours of operation, all of those.
Exactly. The quality of the material at the site.
Aren't most of those covered in Goal 5, those issues?
Yes, they are. For the significant sites, they're described with specificity for the significant sites.
But by removing the reference to specific sites, are you then removing these as issues to be discussed on conditional use sites? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure that I understand your question. I would just, I'm struggling now and really making it up as you're asking the question, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to hunt for an answer. Some way to perhaps describe sites that would be appropriate for mining with a slightly more stringent standard than just a conditional use permit, but something less than the designation as a significant site.
Okay. Are there other questions? Thank you for coming. We have a lot of people that want to testify on this bill, so what I've always tried to do is do no's and yeses on the bill as much as I can. So that's the order in which I'm going to continue to work. I also have a couple people that are here from over 100 miles away, so I'll be sure to get to them. As much as possible, then I'll stay in the order that people have signed up. Cliff Kennegy and Bruce Chapin are the first two people on my list. I'm going to ask them just to come up at the same time. That'll move us along in terms of our testimony a little quicker.
I am Cliff Kennegy, a retired farmer from Benton County. I oppose this bill. This bill would allow the unnecessary destruction of our best farm soils. The current system of requiring extractable sites to be inventoried in advance gives some assurance that good decisions are being made. Earlier generations were not vulnerable to the pitfalls we are faced with. Crews of men going out with teams of horses, wagons, picks, and shovels to local outcropping of aggregate could dig all day, yes, a lifetime, and do no significant damage. Technology has changed that. Our modern equipment in the hands of the unrestrained operators could literally destroy our entire agricultural base in one lifetime. We owe it to future generations to protect their food base. Please vote no on this bill. And I would also like to affirm the testimony that Thousand Friends will give.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Chapin. I'm an orchardist north of Salem. Currently, I serve as the chairman of the Oregon Farm Bureau Aggregate Committee, and I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 3013 as is written. I provide each of you with a copy, I assume it's been passed out to you, of the May 14, 1996 issue of the Oregon Farm Bureau News. And this letter gives a good historical background of what was happening back in 96, which is when the aggregate and agriculture got together and created a compromise. The front page It'll be the fourth page in that packet passed out. But the front page of the newsletter explains what was happened prior to 1996. And the second page outlines the 96 compromise. Let me give you a brief history of what was occurring prior to 96. Backing up, prior to the 1990s, aggregate was not viewed as a significant threat to agriculture. Miners were only interested in rock under shallow soils that were poor for farming, and the volume removed from farmland was small. According to Digami, prior to 1960, more than 50% of the sand and gravel mined in western Oregon was mined out of the rivers and streams. In the 1990s, the environmental movement directed the miners to move out of the rivers and onto prime farmland. Other things occurred also. We had the aggregate mining was being driven away from the heavily populated areas and once again putting it onto agriculture. More efficient mining equipment was developed, making profitable the strip mining of alluvial rock under deep, rich topsoils. 20 years ago, rock under 7 foot of topsoil was considered of no value. Today, it's common form to mine under 25 feet of topsoil. As the population grew, so has the demand for rock, which once again is causing an increased pressure on prime farmland. By 1996, it was apparent that there was a major conflict between the two industries, and Governor Kitzhaber interceded and directed the two industries to develop a resolution to the conflict. What resulted after several months of work and hundreds upon hundreds of man hours was a rewrite of Goal 5. Under the new Goal 5, the aggregate sites has to meet quality and quantity standards. If the site has more than 35% Class 1 and Class 2 soils, then there is also a depth requirement. The objective of these standards was to minimize the acres of prime farmland lost per ton of high-quality rock mined. House Bill 3013 is a step in the wrong direction by providing a method for miners to bypass these agreed-upon standards and thus circumvent the basic concept of the agreement. If you look at the Farm Bureau paper, second page, upper right corner, you will see that both the conditional use process and the Goal 5 process were intended to be used, but for different purposes. A significant sites were to use the Goal 5 process, and the insignificant sites were to use the conditional use process. House Bill 3013 gives the miners the option of using the conditional use process anytime. This would make the 1996 compromise useless. Please do not underestimate the size of the conflict between these two important industries. Aggregate strip mining has become a very large threat to agricultural lands. Attached to the DLCDC report indicating that in a five-year period from 1996 to 2000, new aggregate mining permits affected 38,000 acres. Clearly, this is not a small problem to be taken lightly. The question is not, are we going to mine rock, but where are we going to mine rock? To help minimize the destruction of prime soils, we need to be encouraged the mining of rock under poor soils. One way this can be done would be to allow on poor soils the use of conditional use processes without the Goal 5 quality and quantity standards. The recent LUGA and Court of Appeals decision that prompted House Bill 3013 appears not to allow conditional use permits anyplace. Oregon Farm Bureau's Aggregate Committee recognizes there is a legitimate need for conditional use permits on poor soils and recommends that an amendment be proposed that would allow that. This would be consistent with the goals and objectives of the 1996 compromise and in the best interest of Oregon. After 7 years, it is apparent that there's needs for many changes in the process. It is a mistake to address those issues on a piecemeal approach. The industries need to once again sit down and very objectively and completely reevaluate the whole process. Thank you.
Other questions? I do appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming this morning. And we are going to accumulate a lot of testimony this morning. The next two folks on my list are Art Schlack and Doug. Doug.
Tindall.
Tindall. I wouldn't know that looking
it's
at this.
Spelled O D O T.
It's hard to pronounce. It's not phonetically correct. Senator Starr would really struggle with this, but it's Tindall, O D O T.
phonetically challenged, are we? Art, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here this morning in support of House Bill 3013. Historically, there's been two opportunities to locate mineral aggregate sites throughout the state. One is through the Goal 5 process, and this process is the comprehensive planning process based on Goal 5, and it's intended to identify those significant large sites with quantity and quality of material that is of such value that it should be protected. And in that process, once those sites are identified, the protection not only is for the site itself, but the protection goes to the surrounding properties also, and so that it minimizes, shall we say, future conflicts between, let's say, rural residential development or forest operations or whatever the surrounding land uses may be. There's also limitations placed on those properties or conditions placed on future development that hopefully ensure compatibility with the mineral aggregate operation. The second opportunity to locate gravel sites or quarries is the conditional use permit process. And in the land use process, conditional uses have been historically allowed in certain zoning districts, and they have been looked at to as something that if it's deemed to be compatible and there's adequate services, this is an appropriate use through that conditional use process. The conditional use process, those sites do not have to be on the inventory historically at this point. And we support the two opportunities for locating mineral aggregate sites throughout the state. And based on that support, we support House Bill 3013 because all sites should not have to be on that inventory. That's not what is intended, and it is inappropriate, I believe, to take small sites, a 25-acre site that's intended to maybe support a road project or development in a very small area, and have those go through the Goal 5 evaluation and that process. With that, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Anybody else have questions? I have one question, and I'll be answering it, or asking it, I suppose, more than once. I understand that we have to be real concerned about, especially what's going on in Eastern Oregon, small sites that couldn't afford to go through the Goal 5 process. But if you just wanted to get back to the situation as it was before Beaver State, is this the only approach we could use?
Mr. Chair, it's probably not the only approach. It is a approach. But we haven't sat down to evaluate other approaches at this point.
Let me rephrase the question. Is there an approach that might lessen what I see as two big industries in the state going at it, you know? I mean, they had an agreement in 96. That went until a Luba case and a court case to follow. And supposedly, if we could get back pre-96 to where we were, we wouldn't have to have the war released right away. I'm still working on a compromise. I'm asking you to make any suggestions that might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, that's something I'd have to think about a little bit. I've talked to a couple of people this morning about maybe some different alternatives that might include the Goal 5 process for the truly large sites, and allow in state, you know, in the state statutes that smaller sites would have the opportunity to utilize the conditional use permit process, and that would take us back prior to the court cases, I understand it, and would put us in a position where historically we have, well, at least in, you know, counties and cities have been.
Heard, I've always respected your advice. I'd like to ask you to think about that some more and talk to me. Okay? Are there any other questions? Mr. ODOT, is that it?
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Doug Tindall, the state maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Sorry about my printing. I'll work on that.
Probably writing legibly is not part of your job.
It should be. I'm an engineer. We're supposed to be able to do that. We're not doctors. Sorry for any doctors in the audience. I come to you with a slightly different, or I shouldn't say different, a more focused comment on this bill. I'm not an expert in land use, and so I'm going to describe to you what ODOT was doing prior to what you've heard referred to as this Beaver State case. It was a case in Southern Oregon having to do with an aggregate permit. Most of ODOT's sites are permitted under the conditional use permit process that we understood was allowed in Goal 5 prior to Beaver State. The reason for that is twofold. One is most of our sites are small. They don't meet the quantity standards, and many of our sites are for sand, cinders, or pumice, those types of things that are used for road sand that don't meet the quality standards. So our sites cannot be under the Goal 5 as it exists today, cannot be considered significant. Well, if they're not considered significant and the ruling takes away the ability to do a conditional use permit for a non-significant site, then we have no way to operate the pits that we have today. And that means a couple of things. One, Representative Johnson talked about having pits located in the proximity of projects, which decreases cost. But very importantly, I think, is that we would have no ability to get road sanding material if we don't have our pits. And so we wouldn't have that material applied to the roadway. So our view on this is I understand the policy implications, or I sort of understand the policy implications. I've heard a lot of the discussion. Certainly appreciate the difficult position you're all in. But our position is we'd like to go back to the way it was prior to the LUBA case. I think the chair's question, what would it take, is an interesting question. I thought that this bill returned us, and other people have told me that that is not correct, that it goes farther than where we were before. I don't know that. I'm not a land use guy, like I said, but I do know that we need to continue to operate our sources in the state, and without this bill, it appears to me that that's going to be a problem. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. In the sentence before the ending sentence, you said one thing, and in your ending sentence, I think you said another, because at the end you said, without this bill, your 800 sites are in trouble. But previously you said that potentially that could be arrived at some other way, or at least
No, Senator, what I was suggesting was I thought this bill returned us to the way we were prior to.
And my question is there a way to return us to where we were before the Beaver State case with something that goes farther, which I have heard this bill does? That's my question.
And Chair Shields, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I'm not enough of a land use expert
to
be able to know that.
You can't use it. That answer's already been used this morning.
Well, let me try a different one. I sure wish I could, and I'd be glad to suggest it, but that's the outcome that we need, and I don't know how to put that. I would defer to my colleagues at DLCD, Mr. Rindy, and those folks to possibly suggest that language.
I'm sure we'll be hearing from him, unless he's gotten bored with this hearing and decided to leave us permanent this morning.
He's not that smart.
I'm not going to impugn the intelligence of any of the past, present, or future witnesses in front of this committee. A question for you. Yesterday, you were in a work group where we talked for a good while. We had Farm Bureau people there. We had people from ACAPA there. We had environmental people there. We had Mr. ODOT, there. And at that time, you saw at least proposed amendments that the Farm Bureau made. And those amendments would have grandfathered in, I think, your 800 sites. Is that the way they looked to you at the time?
Chair Shields, I'm not... It appeared that the language that is there, that the intent was to grandfather in the existing sites. One problem we have is that our sites are used in some cases sporadically, so we may get a permit and then let that permit lapse and go back and get the permit subsequently. So you'd have to very carefully construct that language so that it says so that it grandfathered in sites that are or were permitted.
Okay.
But I think it sort of postpones the discussion for a couple of years. The harm there is more on the construction side, I think, in terms of whether or not people, companies are willing to invest to produce the rock. Right next door, they're talking about a package that's going to generate over 10 years over $2 billion of road construction, and we're going to need companies investing in producing aggregate to get that stuff done.
And that's far beyond the 800 sites that you have.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Thank you for your time. I hope that ODOT will not move too far away from us, because other questions may come up.
I'll stay here.
Next on my list is Liz Frankel and Frank...
Lizzle.
Frank?
Here.
Yes. How do you say your last name?
Parisi.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Do I lead?
Sure.
I'm Liz Frankel, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League strongly supports Oregon's statewide land use planning goals, including Goal 5, natural resources, scenic, historic areas, and open space. It is this goal which would be most affected by House Bill 3013 if passed. The effect of the deletion of ORS 215-198 sub 2 to us would be to make new aggregate sites subject only to the local government comprehensive plan conditional use permitting process. No longer would sites require an inventory or a determinants of significance. This process is currently defined very specifically in the Goal 5 rule for aggregate. The original Goal 5 rule was adopted in 1981. This new rule, the product of a long negotiation process in 1996, specifies the details of the inventory and determination of significant process. Several historic cases developed the concept, and I'm not talking about the famous Beaver State case. Several historic cases developed the concept that conflicts between goals or between resources should be balanced. No longer would that concept apply to, for example, balancing Goal 3, agricultural land, and Goal 5, which includes aggregate as a natural resource. And this is largely because that balancing has to occur on the basis of something. And that's when you refer to the rule. The argument that economic development not only does not include the agricultural industry, and that aggregate extraction should trump agricultural crops seems short-sighted. Farm soil goes on and on producing crops. It is a renewable resource. Aggregate, once mined, is gone. It is a non-renewable resource. We suggest that you not support this special interest bill. And I will add, in to answer the question that Chair Shields may ask, what do I think would be a different solution, that is, either opposing the bill, throwing a bill away, or passing it. My big concern comes from political experience. And in the process of dealing with the first time we dealt with the rule, developing the rule in 1981, and this time in developing the rule in 1996, you have a very powerful industry, that is the aggregate industry, very powerful. And you have the agricultural industry, which may appear to you as being powerful, but in my experience, hasn't a candle in terms of wattage when it comes to OCAPA. Which means that you may get a resolution, but it may not be a balanced resolution. I'll try to answer whatever questions you have.
Are there any questions? I do appreciate your testimony. It's a sobering testimony. At least I got your first name right, Frank.
Mr. Chairman, it's
for a few moments here.
My last name is Parisi, and I was the lawyer for Beaver State, and I lost the case in the Court of Appeals. And I'm here in support of House Bill 3013. We could have gone to the Supreme Court, but that would have deprived us probably of the opportunity to come to the legislature. And since the problem created by the Beaver State opinion was so significant, we thought, and since the solution we thought was so obvious, it seemed more prudent to come here and ask you to fix the problem. I'd like to give you a little rebuttal to a few comments from Representative Johnson, and then I have a couple of comments, and then I'd like to open it up for questions. We thought when we introduced 3013 that all we were doing was restoring the situation to the way land use had been for the last 20 years. And it boggles the mind for me to hear people say, well, you're trying to do something else. All we're really trying to do is to allow the old safety valve of the conditional use permit process for the small sites to be put back into play. Now, it may be that the bill is not drafted perfectly, and I know, Mr. Chairman, you were asking people, is there another way to get there? We had a couple of ways. One way was to say that either a significant or a non-significant site could be granted a conditional use permit. And another way, and the way that LC eventually went, was to simply eliminate Section 2 of 215.298. There's probably merits and advantages and disadvantages to both ways, but we chose one way. But the point was to put the conditional use permit process back in play. Now, what amazes me is to hear people say that that will allow surface mining to run rampant throughout the state. I can't follow that. You still have to get the conditional use permit. You're not automatically allowed to mine. And when you go in for a conditional use permit, the standard is compatibility, which means that if your site is not popular, you're not going to get a permit. And that has always been the problem with the conditional use permit process, in terms of it being the only vehicle to provide the state with quantities of gravel. It's really only intended for the small sites or the sites in areas where the geology is such that you can't get a Goal 5 permit. So really what we're trying to put back into play...
Excuse me, what does that mean?
There are places in the state where you can't find deposits that are deep enough, or where you can't find deposits that have enough quantity, or where they won't make ODOT specifications. So on this Beaver State case, for example, the site only had 600,000 cubic yards of material, and it was only 12 feet deep. And the plan that never got to a hearing because of the Luba case was that the site be put back into farming when the 12 feet of gravel was removed. But because it was only 12 feet deep and because the quantity was under the minimum, there's no way to get a Goal 5 permit for that site or for any other site in that part of the state. The geology just doesn't permit it. And this is completely different from the situation in Columbia County that we heard about, where there's millions and millions of yards everywhere you look. So to get back to the context, the conditional use permit process that this bill would allow us to have again is very important for those areas. Now, I think if we don't pass this bill, what happens is, in the large metropolitan areas with large deposits and large companies, things are fine. But in these isolated markets or places with unusual geology, things aren't going to be fine. And in the case of ODOT, all their sites are not available. So for all those reasons, I would support the bill, and if there's a better way to draft it, I'm all for it. But I think for the little guy and for the places where there simply isn't significant sites, we've got to do something.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Any questions? If not, let's get Mike Crannon and Rich Angstrom. So far, I've been able to go right down the list without any changes, and I've taken care of anybody that's come over 100 miles. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. Mike, you're next on the list.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name's Mike Crennan, 18 Royal Oaks, Roseburg, Oregon. I am the Vice President and General Manager of Roseburg Paving, Beaver State Sand and Gravel. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3013. Our companies, Roseburg Paving and Beaver State Sand and Gravel, are divisions of LTM Incorporated. We're a large business, and we've been in business for over 50 years. We're the industry leader in the Roseburg area, and we're also one of the largest employers in our community. That you've heard a little bit about the history behind House Bill 3013, but stems from our company's unsuccessful attempt to permit our Blazina property. We sought listing on a non-significant resources inventory and tried to permit this site as a non-significant resource under the traditional conditional use permitting process. However, LUBA and the Court of Appeals have determined that this approach is not valid. They have closed the door on the traditional conditional use permitting process, and that's why we're here today. The court's decision basically said that the Goal 5 rules were not only intended to protect significant resources, they're intended to restrict mining or limit mining to significant resources. And the consequence of that decision is that in Douglas County, where we have no sand and gravel deposits, to my knowledge, that would meet the Goal 5 definition of significant, the consequence of this is that within about 10 years, we will deplete all of our currently permitted sites. There will never be a new sand and gravel deposit permitted in Douglas County. And these materials will have to be imported from outside the county, outside the state, wherever we can find them. This will result in significant cost increases for sand and gravel, ready-mix concrete, hot mix asphalt. It will result in the loss of local jobs. And the people or entities that will pay these increased costs are primarily city, county, and state government. 75% of our work is public work for the city, for the county, for the state, and for the FHWA. In addition, homeowners will pay these increased costs for materials, private developers, businesses, and industries. When the basic costs of construction materials are increased, may even have the effect of discouraging new business and industries from locating into our areas. There was a little bit of discussion. I made a statement that there are no sand and gravel deposits, to my knowledge, that would meet Goal 5, the definition of significant in Douglas County. The reason for that is that the Goal 5 rules are incomplete. They really only take care of the Willamette Valley. There are 10 counties that are listed. They have to have 2 million yards, and then there's there are some rules related to called the 35% rule for Class 1 and Class 2 topsoils, and then there are depth depth exceptions given for those counties. In Douglas County, there is no depth exception. So ironically, even if we found a source that had sand and gravel to the center of the earth, it could not be significant if it had more than 35% topsoil. To my knowledge, sand and gravel is always overlaid by Class 1 and Class 2 topsoils. There was a comment that was made earlier that this might be okay if it would be okay to mine properties that didn't have good soil on the top. Well, there's no sand and gravel under those properties. That sounds good on paper, but sand and gravel and Class 1 and Class 2 topsoil, at least in Douglas County, exist together. Our typical our Blazina property is as good as it gets. It's a 35-acre site. There's about 600,000 yards of sand and gravel. Our sand and gravel layer is about 10 to 12 feet deep, and it's overlaid by about 10 feet of topsoil. That is as good as it gets. We've been able to stay in business by finding properties like that and supplementing them with in-stream gravel bars. There are no sites that would have 2 million yards or would have, that would be better than that in our area. So the House Bill 3013 is essential for us to continue operating as we have for many years. The other thing that I'd like to point out is while our sites are small, they are also easily reclaimable. The total excavation on this prop on Blazina would be about 25 feet deep, and half of it would go back in to replace what was taken out. Our plans would be to restore this site to farmland at the completion of mining. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify here today and just reiterate in whatever terms I can that our company is in a desperate situation, and really our community is, because without local sources for high quality sand and gravel, we're really in trouble. And cost increases are just something that our community, I don't think, is able to bear given the current economic climate or really any economic climate. And we would very much appreciate your vote in support of House Bill 3013, which restores a conditional use permitting process and authority to local governments for making these decisions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. It gives me a lot to think about. Other questions? Rich?
Good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. OCAPA represents construction and construction materials companies throughout Oregon. We have about 160 members that include aggregate, asphalt, concrete producers. We have farm members, and we have big contractors that we have the whole gamut of landowners throughout the state that mine aggregate. What's interesting about this particular discussion is that the debate continues to move away from the point of the bill, which is to restore a local governments-driven process, one that is highly discretionary, and towards one of this aggregate versus farmland debate. And I think that's unfortunate. I do believe the debate needs to continue to happen. We've had it every session I've been here, and in 96, the Farm Bureau and OCAPA reached an agreement on it, and I'll get into that in a little bit. We have been associated, our industry has been associated with farm and forest lands literally since the Bronze Age. When man first started being domesticated, domesticating animals, growing crops, they started mining aggregates and building communities. We've always been associated with the rural part of the state, including our farm and forest lands. I think it's unfortunate that we couch this debate as one of farmland versus aggregate land, because they're both valuable natural resources and they both need to be protected. What it is, this debate is when, and this is the issue that's squarely before the legislature, when is it that a landowner, any landowner has the right to exploit his mineral resources that's below his surface right. But certainly when he buys his property, he buys his subsurface right and his mineral interest. And it doesn't matter if it's gold, coal, or any other mineral. Aggregate is obviously one of those. That's what the debate is about. And I think it's unfortunate that we have to keep pitting interest groups in the way that we pit them in this building. The bill is designed to restore a conditional use process that's been in play for about, my estimation, 30 years. And when I talked with Mr. Schlack, he said he thinks it was in play, the conditional use process was in play back in the 60s. So certainly before my time, the conditional use process has been one that local governments have used to site aggregate sites. Most sites are in the state are conditional use sites, and it seems to be the most popular one for those that are not contentious and for the small aggregate sites. And the nice thing about it is it's the least expensive process. Goal 5, when you go through the Goal 5 process, your costs and expenses go up extraordinarily. When you use a conditional use process, it's a lot less costly for the operator, thereby holding the cost of aggregates and construction materials and transportation needs down. The agreement that we reached, and I think there was, and I've handed you a copy of the agreement, April 19th, 1996 agreement from the Farm Bureau. And I did need to correct the record because Representative Johnson is very adamantly talked about the industry coming in and trying to break the agreement from one session to the next. And I think that was wrong on her part, and maybe I didn't sit down with her and actually hand her the agreement at one point. But the very first, if you go to the back page, the last page, and this is a letter from Don Schellenberg, the very first point in the agreement is significant aggregate sites shall use the Goal 5 process. All other sites must use the 215-298 process, the conditional use process. We are not changing the agreement. Matter of fact, we're the only ones, it seems, in the room that are trying to honor the agreement and ask the legislature to stick with the agreement. We thought the balance was good in 96. The governor had convened a work task force in 96 to sit and resolve this issue, and they worked this out, and this is the 10-point agreement. The number one point was that we have a conditional use process. And I believe that's true because many farmers throughout the state use the conditional use process to exploit their mineral resources, and that's the easiest way to go. One of the other points I think that needs to be made, and this is very unfortunate, that we're about ready to create a crisis in this building, especially in the area of aggregate. It won't be one that will be felt immediately because there's obviously supply of material out there, but it's a long-term direction that failure to pass this bill will cause. If you remove the small operator throughout the state, one is that, and I'll go through this fairly briefly, but Oregon really has a web of aggregate sites throughout the state. And the small guys fill in all the holes around the urban centers where you have most of the big operators. And they provide a valuable resource for contractors to get construction materials close to the market at a low cost. If those sites go away, and eventually they will with a policy change that doesn't allow for them to for small sites to be sited any longer, what you have done is you have restricted the supply of aggregate in the state. At the same time, you're increasing the demand for aggregate through about a $2.6 billion highway package next door. I'll be testifying next door after I'm done here. And you reduce competition. The price of aggregate is going to go up. There's no question about that. The other thing is I think it's interesting during this particular point in the state of the economy when Oregon is being accused of being non-business friendly, that we're actually looking at maybe eliminating 75% of the aggregate small business sites in the state. I think that's unfortunate.
not all rock needs can be met through Goal 5. You've heard about sand, cinder, and pumice. We'll never meet the quality part of Goal 5. It will not make the abrasion test. Those sites can never be sited. Not all rock is used for road construction and needs to have that kind of density. A lot of rock is used for fill and riprap and other issues that doesn't require the high-quality Goal 5 type of rock. If you don't pass the bill, and Goal 5 sites are the only ones going to be approved, what you're going to be doing is you're going to be putting this high-quality rock into being used as fill material throughout the state. Whereas right now what we would use it for is we'd use it for concretes and asphalt, and we would try to use our lesser quality rocks for the fill. And fill takes an awful lot of material. The coast is, all the coastal counties are in trouble. As many of you know, NOAA Fisheries is looking at removing the industry from the rivers, and that's been a trend going on and a battle going on for a number of years now. The coastal communities only have the hard construction grade aggregates out of the rivers. They don't have Goal 5 sites. Because the coast range was formed underwater, it's called marine basalt, it's soft rock, and it doesn't make ODOT specification. That whole segment of the state is going to be without construction grade materials. Essentially, what happened here is that Mike Crennan's company applied for a conditional use permit. It was denied. It went up to LUBA. LUBA remanded the case back on our grounds, which was essentially, even though it's a highly discretionary process, the conditional use process, they still have to tell the operator up front what criteria it is that they have to make. They can't receive an application, then make the criteria up, and then compare it to the application. We won on that ground. But on cross-appeal, a local landowner cross-appealed and said, "Oh, there's not even authority for conditional use process given the present statutory construction." Nobody agreed with him, but he was right, including the AG's office, who entered the appeal on our behalf. The opponents to the aggregate industry hit a home run. They brought down the whole deck of cards. And the issue before you is squarely whether you're going to allow that to be exploited or you're going to return the system back to the status quo. I will say that the industry is committed and has signed a letter saying that we will sit down in the interim and work out this broader issue. But this is an issue of process. It's not an issue of exploitation, when and where we can exploit the mineral resources in this state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rich. I have a question or two that I want to ask. And this is what you get, you know, when you get somebody that tries to be a generalist, because we have to cover a lot of things. It's been going back and forth. The question, does this just put it back to pre-Beaver State, or does it do more than that?
Chair Shield, I'm glad you asked that question, because on the House side, and then obviously in the discussions that we've had with the different groups, it continues to come up that this particular language does more. We have asked over and over if they can show one substantive way it does. I don't believe there is a substantive way that it does. It causes more collateral issues. But we're open, and when we left the meeting that we had yesterday, we thought that there was more than one way to skin this cat. And I think you've heard this from other folks. You could have defined inventory to include significant, non-significant sites. You could have broken this down, and I thought that's where we were kind of headed. You could have broken this down into significant, how we were going to handle significant, and how we were going to handle non-significant sites. The way this developed, this was not even OCAPA's original stab at the language, but LC and both legislative councils, Harrison and Chris Crane, reviewed this and worked on it pretty hard and said this is the easiest way of doing this, and they didn't believe it had any additional impact. I sent out an email to our entire membership, which includes some fairly substantial attorney firms in the state, to look at it, and they came back, not everybody, but the people that were interested said they don't see that they'll have any collateral impact. It does remove the inventory process that the local governments do, and that is a process where, you know, they essentially, when a site goes through and a permit goes through, they open up a book someplace and they inventory the site so that it's recorded somewhere. This is not the kind of inventorying where you go out and you look for aggregate resources around the state and then you put them on a map someplace and say, here's your future aggregate resources. This is about keeping track of those that are permitted to make sure that they get cataloged. It's a cataloging function. And I know you've heard me say that. Mm-hmm. If it does have a substantive impact, I'm willing to change it. I haven't seen it yet, and the industry has been very adamant from the very get-go. My marching orders from my board is this is supposed to be a status quo bill, and this is how it came out of LC. We've been around and around on it, and we think it's the best fit.
Okay, part of the job then would be to make sure that this is a status quo bill. I want to say to everybody that I really appreciate spending an afternoon with Rich and with OCAPA and looking at a couple of the Morse Brothers sites. I think that the work they do has been terrific. They make less dust than the Filbert farm next door. I noticed that right away. I don't want the transportation plan then to end up costing Oregon taxpayers an extra $100 million or something because we've all of a sudden constricted the amount of aggregate. I really don't want that to happen. I just, as you know, from day one, I've been trying to find some kind of a compromise on this whole thing. And, I guess the one other question that I would have for you yesterday, and unfortunately the building did a bad thing to us yesterday because, I was about halfway done with the day's work and I hope to have a chance to talk to you to follow up with the couple hours we had in the morning. And then we all got run out of here at 3:30. But when we left there, you had seen the proposed amendments that the Farm Bureau had, and maybe it's unfair to refer to them before Don Schellenberg gets a chance to talk about them, but I guess my question is, I'm pretty sure they're not going to be adopted in any way, shape, or form, I know that, but if they were, just hypothetically, would the aggregate industry be prevented from doing anything that it does now if they were adopted?
Yes, we would. And this is the amendments that he put forward requires a little heavier discussion. I can go on for probably another 25 minutes about the issues surrounding these. But I do think, in the spirit of working with the Farm Bureau, this is their proposal to begin discussions. Mm-hmm. And that's how I looked at them. I just think that from the there's no question in my mind that, and they're doing the right thing from a lobby perspective, is they're trying to leverage some policy changes through a time when the industry's suffering. And, that's what happens in this building, and nobody faults them for it. I just think that debate is a huge debate. It involves so many people and so much money. 60% of the material used in this state is used by government. And for every additional mile on every ton of rock, it's an extra quarter. ODOT did a study in the Bend area and showed that just in an annual basis, an extra transportation costs are about $1 million. It costs them about $1 million. So the point is that the issues aren't just about farmland versus the aggregate industry. It's about it's about transportation issues. It's about development and home building in the state. It's about all the types of commerce that we provide to Oregon. We're the first things that go down whenever there's any kind of development in the state, guaranteed. We're the first thing that gets laid down is a layer of base rock or fill, and then it goes up from there. So it's a larger discussion than just kind of laying out some parameters. And I appreciate Don initiating it and taking laying out points of discussion. I think the out still is out of this whole thing is ask the governor's office if they're willing to sit down and convene a group, which I've already pledged that I will be involved in during the interim, to sit down with everybody. Let's all sit down. I think the governor's folks are here, and say, hey, let's sit down and work this through. Come back with a package next session to try to resolve it. But let's at least move the process bill this session so people are protected and the system's protected.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you both. Gary Lynch and Bob Rindy. Chicken.
Gee, thanks.
Does that mean that he speaks first?
No, that's the penalty he has to.
Oh yeah.
First.
You do it. No, you do it.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and my comments will be brief at this time, and similar to what we said on the House side. We permit approximately 900 sites in the state of Oregon, changes monthly. The vast majority of those sites are sanctioned via the conditional use permit process. It's the one of two vehicles that we can use, or the county or the land use authority uses to sanction a site. It's either Goal 5 or it's the CUP process. There are a few minor exceptions to that, but very few. The Goal 5 process is cumbersome, expensive, effective, but the first two cause problems in the sense that the vast majority of the CUP sites, as I think many have said today, are in rural areas and in eastern Oregon, and that frankly, the conditional use permit process, and this is my opinion, is not going to work well out there. And yet, if you take the CUP process away, it's what you lay on that becomes the only sanctioning vehicle for the land use authority. It's funny, we believe that the CUP processes work well. Again, the majority of our sites tend to be in rural Oregon. Obviously, the production tends to be centered in the larger market areas. But in terms of numbers of sites, we see them scattered across the state. The nature of the industry has always been recognized and is established in case laws, in intermittent and sporadic. I will conclude my comments by saying that we believe that the status quo, if that's what this bill returns it to, is an effective way of dealing with this issue. The mining industry, as many of you are becoming aware of if you weren't already, is a polarizing type situation. It's too bad. We can't live without the agricultural industry. We can't live without the aggregate industry, at least the way we currently live. So we would also pledge any support we can to any interim discussions or any other discussions that go on in the interim. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob, your turn.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I did hand you some written remarks, but of course what happens when you write things in advance is I think they probably don't address many of the issues that have come up today. I was at the table in 96 for almost a year with OCAPA and the Farm Bureau hammering out the agreement that Mr. Angstrom handed you earlier. So I've certainly been through these wars for a long time. At that time, the agreement was that we would continue with the conditional use process, and the other 9 points were on the Goal 5 process. We then adopted the Goal 5 process with both sides agreeing. I think where we are today is we don't have both sides agreeing to that agreement, and maybe we have to revisit that. I'm not necessarily looking forward to that. I do think that the answer to this is to convene some sort of discussion, whether that's done in this building or in the interim, to see if we can get back to a better state of agreement on the aggregate mining process. The Goal 5 process, which LCDC adopted in 96, was written and intended for very large sites and primarily in the valley where the farmland conflicts are. The agreement, point one, was that for the rest of the state, we're probably going to rely on the conditional use process, and that's what we have done, not only for the last 5-6 years, but for probably 30 or even 40 years. What we participated in the drafting of this, and I also worked with legislative council in trying to come up with something that would be a status quo bill. I believe we should return the conditional use process in a status quo way and then begin a discussion about where I think the real concern is, which is in the valley and with farmland. And that's not really dealt with by the conditional use process. At the same time, I also have to agree with some of the comments you've heard today that it's not exactly a status quo bill, because what currently the statute says is that for the conditional use process, the counties must put them on an inventory. We chose not to retain that because I think it has been probably just a cataloging operation, as Mr. Angstrom described. I would happily work with legislative council on an amendment to this bill that would say that you still have to have it on an inventory, and try and come up with some definitions that, I think are the way that the process has been working as a status quo bill. And I would pledge to you that I'd work on that if we had some more time. I don't think that's going to resolve the problem, because I think what we're going to find when we're done with that is that the problem is really much deeper than that. And as Mr. Angstrom described, it's much broader. It's very, very complex. I don't think there's time to resolve that, and therefore I would urge you to adopt a bill that returns the process to the status quo, and also pledge to work with both sides to see if we can get some broader agreement on the farmland issue.
Bob, what you're saying then is, from your perspective and LCDC, this doesn't quite return us to the status quo, and you'd be glad to work on an amendment that would more carefully do that?
That's correct.
That would be like a Band-Aid for now, mm-hmm. with surgery postponed till later. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's
what I heard Rich saying, that the discussion needs to occur. I mean, I didn't, and I say this to Rich as well as you, I didn't push the question, but when I asked him about the Farm Bureau's amendments do prevent them from doing things that they do now, and he said, yeah, it does, but it's a huge debate. So I'm assuming that rather than take that 25 minutes he alluded to and go into detail, that's just part of a very much larger debate. What we need to do is make sure we get carefully back to pre-Beaver State. That's the Band-Aid. And then shoot holes in my theory here if you want, because somebody else will if you don't. Is there a problem with this?
That is, Mr. Chair, that's exactly what I'm proposing, is that we please return the system to the way it was pre-Beaver State. I think the Beaver State case was a major error, and we are and have participated in the appeals of that. But we would like to see the system returned. Most of the sites outside of the valley, almost all the sites, are approved through the conditional use process. I don't think this state can exist very long with an economy that problem that we have now if we don't have any process for approving rocks, sand and gravel, aggregate materials outside of the Goal 5 process. It was not designed to handle most of the other situations.
Okay. Any questions? Two more witnesses remain, and that's Carrie McLaren from Thousand Friends and Don Schellenberg from the Farm Bureau. And I heard Rich referred to an elusive representative of the governor's office. Are they here?
They were.
Well, I don't know whether they want to come and talk to us or not.
I'm sorry. I did talk with Dave Antoff. He had to go to another meeting. He asked me to indicate to you also that he supports having a delay so we can at least discuss the issues of returning this process.
Do you know how much of a delay he's asking for?
We discussed a week. If we can get it done quicker.
Amendment?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. Don? Carrie? You can flip a coin, see which one of you goes first.
Ladies first, Mr. Chairman.
Ladies first.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie McLaren, staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm here as, today speaking in opposition of House Bill 3013 as it's currently drafted because it fails to protect highly productive farmland and does not in any way balance the needs of agriculture and aggregate. We've had in some discussions, you know, the question asked of what is the impact of House Bill 3013? Well, by removing an inventory requirement, it changes, and by effectively repealing the legal decision of the Beaver State case, which what the Beaver State case does is it prohibits aggregate mining of farmland unless it constitutes a significant resource. That's what the Court of Appeals found was meant by an inventory in ORS 215-298. By removing the language that requires an inventory, then we are no longer requiring that the aggregate site be a significant site before it can be mined in an EFU zone. Accordingly, what House Bill 3013 does is it opens up all farmland to aggregate mining. Under this bill, there's effectively no portion of farmland that's deemed too important in terms of its quality of production or quality of soils, and no aggregate site that is too small to not warrant mining it. So you have a relatively, and I'm speaking in extremes, of course, here, but a relatively worthless aggregate site and a really, really important farmland site, and that worthless aggregate site can win. And I don't think that that's an appropriate balance. I do think that is the issue that is before you whenever you're dealing with aggregate resources and agricultural resources, because they do at times occur in the same area. There are other sources of aggregate as well that people will talk about in terms of upland gravel, but I will certainly admit to the committee that there are times where these two resources are going to occur in the same place. When we're talking about economy, I think it's also important to realize the economic contribution that agriculture makes to the state. It's a $5 billion industry. It employs over 140,000 Oregonians. So I think we are talking about two important industries to the state. As we have discussed, House Bill 3013 allows the mining of farmland on Class 1 and Class 2 soils. Effectively, what the Farm Bureau had recommended in its amendments that we discussed in a meeting yesterday was that we provide some process whereby our most important agricultural soils are Class 1 and our Class 2 soils, which constitute about 13% of all agricultural soils in the state. But we have some special standards for them and require that basically we have a high enough level of importance of the quality or quantity of aggregate before we allow those lands to be mined. I think it would be very productive to work towards some better balancing in the statute. I do agree with the statement of Mr. Rindy, if I understand it correctly, that the bill as currently drafted does not take us back pre-Beaver. It removes a process that was there prior, that was in place, that is specifically specified in the statute to require that the aggregate resource be on an inventory of an acknowledged comprehensive plan of the county. That is an important process. As I was reviewing some different counties' comprehensive plans and zoning ordinances last night, they do utilize, it seems, the few that I reviewed, a two-inventory process, if you will, where they have an inventory of significant sites and an inventory of other than, you know, non-significant, if you will. I think it's imperative that we, at a minimum, restore it to that level, but I don't want that to replace what is a very important policy discussion that needs to occur in terms of balancing the needs of aggregate and agriculture. I hope that was somewhat clear, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that this committee might have.
Questions? Don?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll start by saying that our position of doing nothing is not the answer here. There are two methods for siting aggregate pits, and you've heard some of this morning, but I want to maybe give a little different twist to it, if you will. There's the conditional use process and the Goal 5 process. They are independent of one another, and they do not intersect. The conditional use process, as you've heard, is the older of the two processes and requires that the site be included on the inventory of the county's comprehensive plan. HB 3013 is only about one thing. Do the words in the statute mean anything? This issue is not how counties have applied the law, or not applied the law, as the case may be, or what the state's interest is in this issue and how the law is applied. The issue is, what does the law require? The issue came to the forefront recently in the Douglas County case. An applicant for a mining permit under the conditional use process was denied because it was not on the county's inventory. The applicant appealed the decision, and Luba ruled that the county was correct in denying the application. The appeals court subsequently upheld Luba's decision, verifying that the words in a statute do have meaning. A proposed site has to be on the inventory of a county's comprehensive plan. We understand there are some unanswered questions in people's minds regarding the viability of existing pits that were authorized without being included in a county's inventory, and some that open and close on an irregular basis. Those questions remain if nothing is done. We do not believe that simply removing the inventory requirement as provided in 3013 is the appropriate answer. Farm Bureau is prepared to offer a compromise that resolves the unanswered questions about previously approved pits and addresses the purpose for the inventory requirement. First, we suggest that the inventory requirement be maintained and that the language be, language be drafted that provides for non-significant site, and that also grandfathers all existing pits that were approved under the conditional use process. Those pits are there now and should be allowed to operate. Second, the purpose of an inventory requirement as part of the conditional use process in an EFU zone is to ensure that we're not unnecessarily destroying our good farmland. We propose that mining be allowed on any farmland if the proposed mining site is not Class 1 or if it is less than 35% Class 2 or a combination of Class 1 and Class 2. And that suggestion mirrors the major provisions of Goal 5. Fourth, we propose a small parcel exemption from the criteria that it will allow a mining permit to be issued for a parcel of 10 acres or less without the inventory requirement, and providing that it is not a justification for an existing or a future expansion of a pit. And finally, we're open to a sunset provision if the parties agree that it would be of value to resolving a larger statewide policy issue regarding agriculture and aggregate. The result of such a proposal would be certainty for existing pits, an easier process for small operators, and some level of protection under the conditional use process for our best farmland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Again, Don, I want to thank you for taking me out and showing me some locations. It's been very helpful to have both you and Rich do that. I've learned a lot about the issue. A question that occurs to me for you is, do you need everything in your amendments that you've suggested to get to a kind of a pre-Beaver State case situation?
Mr. Chairman, the answer would be probably not.
Okay. What I'm thinking here is, you know, and Rich characterized your amendments as a starting place for some discussion. I've heard from DLCD and others that the governor's people, and I know they were out in the hall, my staff came up and alerted me that they actually wished that yesterday's conversation could have and would have gone on longer. I don't know what they have in mind, but they did ask for a week. And the way I understand this committee, we're allowed to work on the bills that have been approved as long as we want. Is that not true?
That's my understanding.
So, since this is all the testimony I have, and since I know that the governor has asked for that week, and since I know that you and Rich and Thousand Friends and LCDC and all the rest that are interested need a have your input during that week. I always said to everybody that I was an absolute maybe on this bill. You know, I want something that preserves that million-year-old farmland as much as possible. I also don't want to screw up a transportation package. We need aggregate. We got to find a compromise somehow. I know that I'm the amateur that's telling all you guys that sat around for years and that are the experts that it's going to take time. okay, it's going to take time, but let's put on a Band-Aid during the next week and then go into surgery. And I've got a letter from Rich Angstrom already committing himself to this ongoing dialogue. So let's do that. Okay?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Fisher.
Don, if you're going to hold to an inventory, who supplies that inventory and how accurate is it? How do you get new opportunities on that inventory? Obviously, discoveries are made and things are found from time to time. There has to be a process. How does that work under the provisions that we have been operating under?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I'm not quite sure that I understood at least the first part of your question.
Well, you said this place down there was not on the inventory.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
What difference does that make if it is an inventory? How does it get on the inventory? There's be no reason that I could see that it should not be on the inventory. As I said, you discover different things from time to time. We have oil exploration, and they think they don't have any oil left anywhere, and then they find a reserve that's bigger than anything they've ever had before, and all of this kind of stuff. So obviously, not everybody knows in Douglas County where all the potential things are. So you have to have some kind of an ability to change an inventory list or to add things to an inventory list. How is that process done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, it's been Farm Bureau's position for a long time that there should be an inventory under Goal 5, and again, I said Goal 5 doesn't intersect with this, but under Goal 5, the county is supposed to inventory all of their Goal 5 resources. Aggregate is a Goal 5 resource, and so they are supposed to inventory all their significant resources.
We just had testimony that said there was no significant resources in Douglas County, which I would have a tendency to agree with. So how do we get these little spot parcels that somebody discovers from time to time on an inventory? And I'm not talking about a Goal 5 inventory. I'm talking about the other end of it.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, that traditionally has been done on a case-by-case basis, as you indicated, as they discover it. They bring it forward to the county and ask that it be put on the inventory. That's how that can be done. That's how it has been done. It doesn't necessarily mean that, doesn't have to mean that they're going to mine that site immediately. In the past, it has worked in that oftentimes, I guess, they do ask for it to be put on the inventory and ask for the permit to mine the site at the same time.
Other questions? I'm going to adjourn the hearing on House Bill 3013, and I'm going to open a hearing for a few minutes on 2473A. And I'm going to ask, we had Representative Butler here earlier, Tom McDonald and Joe Rowlater, if they'll come up for a few minutes. All right. Our problem, and I'm going to say this before Senator Corcoran gets out of the room, is that the amendments on this bill are just proposed amendments, and they're not all done yet. So I want to hear your testimony, and then we'll have to bring this back when we bring the other bill back. That's all I can do at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. Did you want to start, Joe?
Yes. Senator Shields, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rowlater. I'm here today representing Desert Springs Trout Farm in relationship to House Bill 2473. The handout you got from Representative Butler has some information in it about this bill and how it came out of the House. This is an existing program that's been in place since 1999.
The original intent of House Bill 2473 in this session was to remove the extension, or remove the sunset, and make this program a permanent program. That bill passed the House, and when it came over here to the Senate, we realized that we needed to amend the program to really make the program a working pilot program. And essentially, we've started over again with a pilot program. The A2 amendments, what the A2 amendments do, and the conceptual amendment that you proposed last night, would take this pilot program and give it a new start. It would still be the 10% that's in existing law without the conceptual amendment.
Okay, hang on a minute. You're saying the one that I proposed. This is the one that Representative Butler proposed.
Okay.
To me.
I'm sorry, I got caught in that fire drill last night. I didn't have a chance to speak to you personally, and so I didn't really know where that amendment came from.
Representative Butler and I were on the phone, essentially, when the building was shut down. And he's the one that suggests this first proposed amendment to replace the requirement that departments spend at least 10% of the annual trout hatchery funds with the requirement that this department spend, and this is his wording, no less than the amount spent by the department during the 0103 biennium. So that's his.
Okay, thank you. I stand corrected. I am sorry, Senator Shields. I didn't understand the origin of that.
I don't want to be an author of anything that I'm not the author of.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, a combination of the conceptual amendment and the A2 amendments would establish a benchmark of the 0301 biennium as the amount the department is required to spend, not less than. In private aquaculture through 2010. It also establishes a working group to look at the issues around this program, and I believe that Representative Butler put out his proposal on what that working group would look like, and additionally the department reports to the next legislature. So what we get in these, a combination of the conceptual amendments and the A2 amendments, is we get an amount certain that the department devotes to this program. The program continues to 2010. The next legislature gets a report from the department, and the commission appoints a work group. So I think that's, in a nutshell, what the total of this bill and the conceptual amendments would do. Mr. McDonald, who is the owner of Desert Springs Trout Farm in Summer Lake, has been the major successful bidder on this program, and he's here today with some pictures of his product and his operation. So go ahead, Tom.
Tom, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair. These fish that you see here, these are some 4-pound fish that we have at our facility. The second page shows our facility, and on the bottom picture of the second page, it shows our cleaning operation. And on the last page, it shows the sediments out of the ponds. After it's pumped out in the pond, it pumps into pipes that run along the raceway, and then it goes down into a settling pond. And I just wanted to show you how we do clean our ponds and how.
That's on the second page, right?
On the third page. On the third page shows the water dewatering after we have pumped. Second page on the bottom shows using the pumping system to pump the waste out of the tanks. And then on the third page, it shows you the waste going into the pipe, and then it shows it discharging into our settling pond where we settle it out and clean the, and let it dry, and then we use it for fertilizer on our fields. And these bigger fish are what we stock at Diamond Lake, and we've just got a letter from Diamond Lake. They just faxed one in. It is. Yeah, there it is. And Diamond Lake was pretty much a dead issue on fish before 1999 when we came into the program, and we've been supplying 2-pound fish. And this last weekend, We supplied 5,000 pounds of the two-pound fish just before it opened up, and then we took up some 4 to 9 pound fish in there and tagged them for their derbies. And they've got, I talked to them this morning, and they've had real successful weekend from the years that it's been real poor. And it has been an exceptional program in getting a lake that's got problems back on track.
You're leading me somewhere that I probably shouldn't go this late, but you have a solution for Diamond Lake. I mean, it's nice that you put these trophy fish in there, and that's attracting people back, but you have something that could get rid of the chewy chub?
We feel that if we do plant a bigger fish into Diamond Lake and a more aggressive fish, it can eat the chubs. Our fish are wintering over good. The only food source in the lake is the chubs. And we feel that it is a viable option. Even if they do get the poisoning, you're not going to get 100% kill on the poisoning. And if you do use a bigger fish in there, you can knock that down and keep it down rather than have it crop back up again.
The reason I want to tell the committee, the reason I asked that question is because I've heard it's going to cost $4 million to run around Diamond Lake, which is the plan they have right now. And what
that
would
plan's been around forever.
Yeah, what would this solution cost, do you think?
It would probably cost around $150,000 to $200,000 a year to put the bigger fish in there to do it.
Hmm. Anyway, it's just an aside on this whole issue.
And the cost issue of what we raise our fish for, we have warm water. Our water is 61 degrees year-round and never changed. We can raise fish on an average of at least 2 times faster than anybody else. And when you get into the bigger fish, most people can't have them because it takes so long to raise a bigger fish that we can really kick a bigger fish out in short order. We can have a fish like this, a 4-pound fish here, in less than 2 years.
Senator Corcoran asked the question earlier, how can you guys get that fish raised cheaper than ODFW?
It's the warmer water that we have, and so they eat the same year-round. They don't have, like on a lot of the other ponds or trout hatcheries, the water gets so cold in the wintertime that they don't grow. They just maintain. And it just, this warm water really makes it unbelievable how fish grow.
We're going to have to prepare some amendments so that we have them in front of us. And since we have to come back on 3013, we'll come back on this. Okay? I'm going to close.
Thank you, Senator Shue.
Hearing.
Members of the committee.
On, what are we on? On House Bill 2473, and we'll bring that back next week. Now, the question for the committee is a question for you, which what you want to do with this.
We'll get it done.
Can we open and have a very brief hearing and work session on 2754 and kick it out? I don't think it's a controversial one.
Which one is that?
Could you explain it real quick?
Yes.
Let me just open the hearing briefly. 2754, House Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2754 allows soil and water conservation districts to acquire conservation easements and highway scenic preservation easements. It does require public hearing prior to that acquisition. It allows the districts to make rules regarding care, use, and management of the easement, and the measure does declare an emergency effective on passage. It has no revenue and minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. John McDonald, could you come up real quick and just talk to us for a second on this bill? What was the vote in the House?
The House vote was 49-7.
Why did 4 people abstain?
We have 3 people excused.
Just kidding, Judith. Oh. I don't care.
Go ahead, John.
Probably medical leave over in the house.
Yeah, that's probably
true. A lot
true.
Of them died over there, you know.
They're going from both sides. Yeah, well, anyway.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee.
It's a pleasure to take a few minutes. Most of the information is in the handout that is given to you. It's actually in two parts. The first front and back is kind of a general introduction to what our interest is in being holders of conservation easements. My name is John McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I am also a District Director of the Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District and a hazelnut grower, and I apologize for causing more dust than any aggregate mining operation in the county.
Just a nutty farmer. Huh?
Just a nutty farmer, yes, sir. And I hope we even have more of them this year. We can maybe pay the bills. This is actually a bill that is the second time around. It was introduced in 2001. On that occasion, it passed 30-0 in the Senate, but it never had a hearing in the House.
And this time it passes the House?
This time it passes the House, and we're now here to the Senate to see if we can...
Is this identical to the one we passed 30-0?
Yes.
Do you want this bill, or do you want to keep talking?
I want the bill.
What do you think? Let's close the hearing on House Bill 2754 and open a work session on 2754.
Chair, I move House Bill 2754 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2754 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just move that we compliment Mr. McDonald on his short hearing, short testimony.
Yes, I think we should compliment him. You are hereby complimented.
Appreciate that, Chair Shields. Brevity is sometimes not admirable.
But those are the opinion that Senate Bill 2754, House Bill, I keep doing that, House Bill 2754, vote aye and those opposed no. Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Senator Beyer will carry the bill. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you, members of the committee.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 2754, and we'll adjourn the committee.
Thank you.